Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Scott F. from the Miracle Group in Bristol.
Thank you very much. My name is Scott Fleming. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the group for the kind invitation to come out here tonight with you and share a little of me with you and you with me. It's good to come up here, you know. It's good to be invited back places, you know, today. I've been here over the years. And it was good to come up and see friends, you know, like Lauren, who was at my group in service not too long ago, and run into Jimmy, who I've known for years now and admire and look up to, and like Rich as well. And maybe there's others here that I've known over the years. But that is so valuable to me that I have friendships. And I have a network that's become huge, you know, where my life before I got here, or when I got here, was small. You know, I was all alone. As Bill describes in our big book, you know, I experienced that loneliness that only alcoholics know. Which is strange, because I come from a family that gave me nothing but love and support and encouragement. You know, my mother and father are great people. I don't know any people that are better than them. So my environment was healthy growing up. It wasn't perfect, but it was healthy. But in me, as I grew up and I was around people, I experienced, you know, being threatened by you. I experienced a lot of fear, and for me, I don't think after going back and forth for a lot of different times, I don't think I was born alcoholic. I believe alcohol, I have to drink alcohol to become alcoholic. But I think I was born with, if I had to kind of describe it in one way, with an exaggerated ego. You know, I think I never felt like I measured up. And the way I can see that now, looking back, is that I like to feel superior over people. Like my brother, when he was born a year and a half after me, man, he was a beautiful baby boy. I should have taken care of him, excited. I abused him. I made fun of him. I put my hands on him. I did despicable things to my brother to make myself feel better. I mean, growing up, to the point where it would make me cry, like, when I thought about it. So that's like how I compensated, you know, to make myself feel better. Early on, and as I grew up, I'd have to feel better than you. And around 13 years old, alcohol came into my life, like it comes into most kids' life. But for me, it was that night, it was something profound happened. It was very powerful. You hear members talk about it as being magical and all that. It was very profound and very powerful for me. It instantly allowed me to connect to you. I felt like the guys that I was with that night wanted me there, and I belonged with them. I was able to talk to girls before. I was deathly afraid of them. So it gave me things, allowed me to do things and be things that I always wanted to do and be, but I never could. So that very night, alcohol became, for me, the most important thing in my life. I know that because I thought about it every day from that moment on. I couldn't wait to get to the keg on the weekends and how am I going to get money to get beer? What older guys do I get? So I'm already planning my life around booze. And I go through high school, a pretty popular kid who liked to party, and I liked that, you know, and it felt like fun. I know today it wasn't fun, because I know real fun is, but it felt good. And I'm a feel-good kind of guy, so I ran with it, you know. And I played a lot of sports in high school. I played four, and I was flown down to North Carolina my senior year, 18 years old, to play in front of a coach. And while I'm at this college down there in North Carolina, they had this regional finals outdoors, but there was a rain delay, and it wouldn't stop raining, so we had to move it into the Raleigh Cricket Club to finish the tournament. And when we were in there, myself and this older guy on the team, we noticed that there was a wedding reception in a lobby and a keg being set up, you know, for this reception. And we kind of looked at each other, and we kind of both came up with the idea, why don't we steal this keg, put it out in the bushes, get his buddy to come get it with his pickup truck and take it back. And that's what we did. We stole that keg from that reception in that Raleigh Cricket Club. We put it out in the bushes. His buddy came and got it. They, you know, after the match, we went back and we pretended like we were going to bed, and we snuck out of that dorm, and I went out all night, and I drank all night. As an 18-year-old kid, a senior in high school, I'm at college already partying. And I knew that that was the college I wanted to go to. You know, so I returned home, and I graduated by the skin of my teeth. Now, you know, I was never a good student, which was, I was like a D-minus student, you know, my whole life, which made it tough because my mom's a teacher. My whole family are teachers. But, you know, I played sports and I just got by and I graduated. I almost had to do summer school my senior year. And, of course, I drink that night that I graduate. And I go on this bender throughout the whole summer where I don't stop drinking, basically. I'm at my friend's house whose parents are gone we're allowed to hang out there and party, and we're partying, and halfway through the summer, I get arrested. Now, I'm 18 years old, and I'm now facing some consequences for my drinking, like real ones. My mother and father, like, my immediate family, there's no alcoholism, but my mother and father come from alcoholism. My mom's one of 7, and my dad's one of 11. And there was alcoholism there. So they knew what it looked like. They knew what it felt like. They grew up around it. So they already knew that I had a problem, and they've been asking me to get help since I was about 17. So for a year, they're saying, would you go, Scott, we think you have a problem. Can you go get help? But I'm not going to let you take away the one thing that makes me feel comfortable, my own skin at 17. No way. The one thing that allows my spirit to come out and play? No way. But now I'm facing charges. And I wanted to go away to that college, because I liked the way they partied, and I thought, you know what, if I go into rehab, I'd appease my mother and father, and the judge would be leaning on me because it looks good that I'm getting help. So I go into rehab, Living Grid, at 18 years old, with no thoughts I'm going to stop. But as I'm in there, I can't help but listen to these old men. They were like 30, 40 years old. You know, they were talking about things that they lost that I was about to embark on, like a scholarship, like an education, like a career. And I heard like some of them talking about things with such shame and remorse. It was palpable. They were saying things like they haven't seen their kids in 5 years, or, you know, they haven't, their mother and father died before they got to see them do anything with their life. And I also, in that rehab at that point, could see the truth with alcohol in me, that it was too important to me at 18 years old. And I really didn't want to end up the way they ended up. So I said to myself, I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm going to make my mother and father proud. I'm going to take advantage of the scholarship. I'm going to go away. I'm going to play tennis. I'm going to get an education, have a career. And I set off to do that. Man, I didn't drink for 29 days. The 30th day is when my parents dropped me off of college and they drove away. And I had no idea what I was up against. I really thought I wasn't going to drink. I thought I'd find the guys that didn't drink. I thought, you know, and I wouldn't have drank if I wasn't asked the wrong question that night. But the guys on the tennis team came to my dorm room and they said, you want some beer? And I said, yeah, give me a six pack of Bud Pounders. Just like that. It reminds me of our history. I love the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been studying it since this gift got to my heart, because I want to know how did it get to me? And in our history, when Hazard's with Jung in Switzerland in 1931, right? We see in our literature that he wants to stop drinking. He's there voluntarily. He could have left at any time. He stayed a year with this doctor, and he thought he was fixed. Doctor says, you're good to go. And we're told that the next day in Paris, he's asked if he wants wine at dinner, and he says yes, and he drinks, and he's baffled. And he goes back to the doctor begging him, I thought you fixed me. What happened? See, I didn't know I had no defense against the first drink. I didn't know what I was up against. And that night, they came back with that alcohol, and I cracked it. I put it to my lips, and it went into my body, and my bloodstream, my eyes watered up, and I got that feeling right here that I love more than anything else in the world. And I said, I remember thinking, what was I doing not drinking for 29 days? This is the best feeling in the world. And I was off to the races. I couldn't stop drinking that night. It was 5 a.m. I'm still drinking. Everybody else has passed out. And I called my aunt, a phone call that I'd be embarrassed about for a long time, crying because I didn't want to drink, and the things I learned in rehab, and why am I drinking? I came to the next morning, and it was on. Man, I couldn't stop. Within a year and a half, I was out of that school. Never did I play one match of tennis. I had the dean had me in his office, and he said, Scott, if you don't leave voluntarily, we're gonna arrest you and press some charges, because we got some surveillance camera. You're doing some illegal things. That kind of helped me, you know, make the phone call home, that cry for help. I said, Dad, I got to get out of here. Wasting people's money, not playing tennis, not going to class. I couldn't go. I'm 19 years old. I'm in my sophomore year. It switched so fast for me that this is the curse of alcoholism. where it once lit me up and made me feel like I was a part of, and it was magical. Now I'm drinking more and more and more. I'm not getting the same effect. I'm antisocial. Nobody wants to be around me. I'm getting into fights. I'm feeling depressed, angry, alone at 19 and a half years old. And I call my father and he flies me home because I have great parents, and I enroll in Bucks County Community College, and I would have been a number one tennis player there. I went for 2 weeks and then I couldn't go anymore because alcohol was too important. And I start to go to the woods and drink with the guys that drink like me. And I start to live a life that's meaningless and purposeless. And it's all about booze. And, you know, I could tell you the war stories, man, but I don't think that's what we really relate to in here. I had the DUIs, I've been locked, all that stuff being locked up. What I want to tell you is this, is that inside I was becoming more confused. Inside I hated myself. I didn't want to tear my family apart, which I did. My sister was 10 years younger than me. Man, when my sister was born, I fell in love with my sister. I raced home to get her, pick her up in a bus stop when I was younger. I taught her how to ride a bike. Man, and now in her most important years in the house, I'm taking them hostage and I'm abusive. My parents would beg me to leave. I took a girl hostage for 8 years. I used to say it was a girl, an ex-girlfriend. It wasn't. I didn't treat her like that ever. I used and abused her. I drug her through my alcoholic life. She was always there for me, and she would always take me back in. And you know, eventually she cut me off. I don't think I'd be here if she didn't cut me off. I would get jobs. I would progress quickly up the organization, and then I'd have an apartment and making good money. And then the lights were off, and the landlord's knocking on the door. You haven't paid your rent in 3 months. You got to go. I could never hold down an apartment in my 20s. I could never hold down a job. I'm bouncing around on friends' couches, virtually homeless through my 20s. In the end, I thought I was schizophrenic. Now, my mom's a teacher, and she's had me in front of therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists, and guidance counselors since I was a child. And I've been on meds, you know, and for me, since I've gotten here, I'm not. But that's not everyone's experience. I know that. But for me, you know, when I'm in my late 20s and I'm out of my mind, I'm up for days drinking and I'm hearing things, I start to see things, I really think I'm schizophrenic. And I'm in front of a doctor telling him I'm schizophrenic. See, because I'd rather be schizophrenic than you tell me it's the alcohol. Because I can't imagine life without booze. And I'm on meds for schizophrenia and I'm here and I'm drinking still and I'm telling you here, it didn't help. I got to a place where I couldn't work. Couldn't work. Begging my parents to go back in their house. Mom and dad saying, you got 2 weeks, but you can't drink here and you got to get a job. I don't know why, but, you know, because for a long time that rehab came to my mind after I was on runs, you know, and this one day, not unlike any other. I came to after a night of drinking. I do remember being with a friend who cared about me, and she was pointing some things out about me. And I came to that next morning, and I don't know, man, I think the pain was great enough. And I started to like tear up, and the realization of my life came to me. And I remember kind of crying out to something, and that rehab came to my mind, and for some reason I made that phone call that time. And the rehab said, well, why don't you come on in? And I said, can I come in on Monday? Because it was a Friday, you know. And they said, no, come on in now. And I went in, and I didn't answer their questions, honestly, because I didn't want inpatient. I wanted outpatient. And they gave me outpatient. I'm going 4 to 9 every day. I'm feeling safe at this outpatient. From 4 to 9, I'm feeling safe from booze. I'm shot at and hit, hurting. But there was a problem, man. This outpatient group, they wanted you to make meetings. I wasn't going to come to your meetings. I was sentenced to AA when I was 20 years old for a DUI. I made half a meeting. It was so smoky, you couldn't see anybody. You didn't have to worry about anonymity, you know? And it was a bunch of old guys commiserating, like holding on to their chair, making. I thought, this is no fun. I left that meeting. I got my buddy who was in AA at that time to sign all the rest of my papers for the courts. So I wasn't coming out, folks. How fun could this be? But one day after the group of me making excuses for not making meetings, Dennis, the counselor, said, if you don't go to meetings, you can't be a part of this group. And I was afraid to not be a part of that group. I was afraid I would drink. So I was nudged into Alcoholics Anonymous from an outpatient treatment, you know, center. And I walked into the Greater Levittown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which would become my home group. I didn't know it that day, that night. I walked in and I sat on the back wall and thought my life was over. But thank God I was broken. So I was able to listen. Like, I'd never been on a cell phone in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and I hope I never am. And if you are, that's fine. We can still be friends. But my experience is, I give reverence to this life-saving, life-enriching place for my own and those around me. And thank God I wasn't on my cell phone that night. Because as I was a dying man, and today, by the way, I'm just as desperate. When I was a dying man that night, 16 years ago, Larry A. was speaking. And when he spoke, I paid attention to him. And as he spoke, a few things happened to me on the inside. It's like kind of like, number one, I kind of realized that this guy's happy without drinking. And also I kind of realized that he drank like I did. Very important. And number three is I believed him. Like, I knew he was telling me the truth. And I got hope instantly. And everyone surrounded me that night in the meeting, because I put my hand up as scared to death, but as the first time, you know, in the meeting of AA and at that group. And everyone surrounded me and welcomed me to that group with the handshake. Tall Paul, to this day, when I see him, I still tell him, you're the first person that shook my hand in AA. You don't know how much that means to me. Larry A, I just saw him at the Cape May Roundup. Every time I see him, I tell him, whoever's around him, this is the first man I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you know how important, and they know how important, he knows it, but I need to say it because it is so important to me. That man gave me hope that night as I was dying. And I fell in love with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous from the day I walked in here to this day. I know it's not everyone's experience, but it was mine. I know it's not everyone's experience because that night I was walking down the handicap ramp leaving, and Frank was walking up complaining about these meetings. He's saying under his breath, I guess if I make these meetings the rest of my life, I'll stay sober. God bless him. Frank can't stay sober to this day. Not my experience. I love Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I wish I could go to them all day long. I get in my little car. It's all I had left. I drive to my parents' house. Now my parents want me to live with them. I think my parents want me to live with them today, you know, with what you've done to me. And I came back to AA every single day. I was out of my, like I said, I couldn't work the first few months. I was out of my mind. And in my the clubhouse, there was meetings at 9, noon, 5:30, 8, midnight. I went to every meeting. And on club time, in between the meetings, I talked to Nancy K, my hero in AA with 35 years. Bob C with 45 years. Would hurt your feelings in a meeting because after you got done sharing, he shared something about your share that made you feel stupid. I came to love that guy. And you got to go through those feelings in AA to stay sober sometimes. Adam P, 42 years, man. He called me Cakes because he saw I took an interest in him and the long-timers. And he took an interest in me. And he dispelled his wisdom to me. And when he died, I got to be at his funeral and say some words at his funeral. Those people are my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were there for me. And I kept coming back every single day around the clock, like my life depended on it, because it did. I got very active in here. I started to attend your business meetings right away, which were very interesting, you know. And I became the alternate intergroup rep. Like, with 3 months of sobriety, and Sarah, the intergroup rep, drinks after, like, when I'm, like, a month later. So I become the intergroup rep. So I'm in service at that level in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never been not in service since then, and I'm not saying that to say, way to go, Scott. I'm saying, it's the joy of my life. What else would I be doing? And Sarah eventually got sober again. Had some, just a report, some good news. She actually, I'm good friends with her. She just spoke at one of our meetings. But I'm this active in AA. I am doing, like, I'm chairing meetings. I'm cleaning up your ashtrays. I don't smoke. I'm making coffee. I didn't drink coffee back then. I'm showing up early. I'm staying late. I'm doing anything I can to be in service. I'm branching out to other meetings. I got a pocket full of guys' numbers. Guys' numbers. We're going to the diners afterwards. We're talking about things we heard in here and how our lives might change. I'm doing everything Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to do. Everything. Except for 12 things. And my life got so good externally, so quick in here, it doesn't even make sense. I don't know what your dreams are. Maybe you have them. Maybe you don't. I have dreams. I've always had dreams. I'm not going to apologize for them. Since I was a kid, I always wanted to be a good son, a good brother, a good friend, a good guy in the community, a good student. I never could be those things. Other dreams I had that weren't as important, but they were still dreams, where I always wanted to travel the world. Since I was a kid, I was fascinated with globes and maps. When I was 15, I said, Mom, all I want is a map of Europe. I stared at that thing. Never went anywhere. Couldn't get off the bar stool. Was too afraid to live. And anyone that did live, I hated them. Like my mother and brother traveled the world after they worked hard for the money. My mom never invited me. I wonder why. I hated her for it. My brother was younger than me. He traveled the world. He worked hard for that money. Man, I hated my brother for it. I won't be that guy in AA. Man, I'm your cheerleader. I hope your life goes wildly successful. I will cheer. I'm here to cheer you on. Come back. Tell us how good it is. Well, the things that are happening to me from just loving AA, going to meetings and being in service were, my mother showed me off to the family at 5 months of sobriety, 4 months of sobriety. Look at our son, his skin, his eyes, he's back. My sister writes a poem that I'm her hero after 3 months. I told you I was abusive in the house for years. Tearjerker. The girl that cut me off, who wouldn't take my calls or my knocks on her door for, I knew it, it was done. I couldn't believe it. Threw me into a panic attack. Actually, I had to steal my father's Klonopin to settle me down because she was my security blanket. That girl's calling me. She's calling me saying, I heard you're sober. I'm going to AA. I want to see you. These are the things that are happening to me from just coming here, loving AA, being in service. At 5 months of sobriety, my brother says, let's go to Ireland. Now I have a little, something else I learned right away was that when you come here and you stay sober, to me, part of step 7 is finding out what your other gifts are God gave you. I mean, this is the master gift right here, hey, being sober, hey. But within that gift, what else did God make you for in this world? What are your talents, your abilities, you find those things out. And I found out early on that I had a mind for business. So I'm sober now. I'm living at home, rent free. I put that gift to work and I got a little thing started. I got some money in the bank for the first time in my life with a checking account. I don't have to pay rent because my parents are in love with me. You know how it is when you first get sober, and I got money piling up. Right? Not piling up, but I mean, I got money in the bank. My brother says, let's go to Ireland. I got money in the bank. My parents are in love with me. I got a little business going, and I come across a meeting list for all the meetings in Ireland. And as I cleaned up the closet of the clubhouse, I thought, that's a sign to go. So I take this trip for 10 days up in over to Ireland. First day in Shannon, Ireland, we get off the plane. I knew it was going to be hard. I was looking at the Ring of Curry thinking, why can't I have a few beers with my brother on the second day? On the third day, I'm in the hostel. My brother meets a friend, and they're out drinking. And I'm sitting there going, why? And I'm going to meetings in Ireland. I'm making meetings. But I can't get the drink off me. I'm calling people back up my home group, and I can't get the drink off me. The third day in, I make a conscious decision. I'm drinking before this is over. I know I'm going to drink. The fourth day in, we end up in Donegal in a restaurant. My brother orders a beer because he can drink. I want to drink so bad it hurts. I would have drank if it wasn't for my brother. But I already told you I abused him and hurt him my whole life. I couldn't do it to him. And he knew I was a sober member of AA, and I said, Will, I got to get out of here. We left and went to our bed and breakfast. I went to the bathroom and I shut the door. I didn't know what to do. I was pacing in there. But thank God for paying attention in here, not being on my cell phone. I heard what I needed to hear. I heard that at some point in your sobriety, the only thing between you and a drink will be God. And it was my time. It was either drink or do this. So I didn't know what to do. I dropped on my knees and I said, God, I want to drink, but I don't want to drink. Please help me. And I didn't drink. But even more than that, I didn't want to drink after I got off my knees. It's the first time that ever happened to me. Since booze hit my lips at 13, it owned me, and it's the only thing that ever owned me. I was a slave to it. I answered the call every time. In my 20s, I would walk to the Edgeley Inn in my town, the little dive bar where I had no car, I had no job. I get jobs like, you know, jobs I get. My buddies own roofing companies and siding companies. You know, I could call out on Monday, come in on Tuesday, get an advance on Wednesday, call out Thursday, go back Friday, be gone for 4 days. They'd take me back over just so I could support my drinking. And I would wake up sometimes or come to and with my crappy life, walk into that dive bar and I would be crying tears because I didn't want to go drink. But I had to. And I'd wipe my tears off and I'd go in and order my alcohol. Or I'd have tears falling into mugs of my beer. And now it's taken from me? I knew something happened. I even flew to Scotland on my own. My brother had already been there. He wanted to spend more time in Dublin. I'm walking around the streets of Edinburgh, Scotland, 6 months sober, alone in a foreign city, and the bar lights were flashing, which to me are the most attractive things in the world. And there was no pull. There was no, I wish I could. I was free. I flew back to Dublin to meet up with my brother. And on the flight home, I opened up the big book. See, there was I had the big book, but I wasn't doing much with it. I'm not a victim of AA, though. I hear a lot of people that are. I wasn't. Man, I might have heard 99 people in my home group talking about don't drink, make a meeting, and that's fine. And maybe that works for them. But I did hear that one guy who said, if you want permanent sobriety, if you want a life that's useful and out there doing whatever you want without alcohol being in it, you got to take these steps. Like all of them. I was afraid of that guy. I was afraid of that message. So I heard it, but I thought I was fooled by my life getting good around me. And how do I know? I look at my experience. I'm in Ireland living a dream. I want to drink worse than I ever did. So it's got nothing to do with the things around me. It's the inside job that I was afraid of. Because if you got to know me, you wouldn't like me. I was riddled with shame. And if I told you the things I did and how I lived, you would use them against me because that's what I would do to you. So I wasn't putting my guard down. I wasn't. So as I opened up that big book, because now I'm interested, and there was a guy trying to sponsor me named Jimmy Wild. Jimmy said to me when I kind of first got acclimated with the group, he looked at me and said, Scott, don't you think guys with 5 years need guys to sponsor stay sober? And I thought I'd do him a favor and let him sponsor me, you know? But as he's in the basement with that book open, I'm not receiving the gift. I'm not paying attention as my life depends on it. So I open up the big book on the flight home now with a different set of eyes. And what jumps out at me is this line that says, either God's everything or he's nothing. Either is or he isn't. What's your choice to be? It's the first thing I saw when I opened that book on that plane. And I knew he was. And I knew that I would be okay for the rest of my life if I depended on him. That's really all I ever wanted in life, was to feel okay. Booze came close, but it wasn't real. This was real. And I knew it with everything in my being. And this other thought came to me, this inspirational thought or intuitional thought. It said, when you get off this plane, go see that man that you were afraid of but attracted to at the same time. His name was John Bragg. Bob Bellerby was his sponsor. And John was in my home group, man, I loved it because when he talked, it came from somewhere deep. He had a peace about him. After the meeting, he'd be at a table like that with guys around him, book open, and I knew he wouldn't be there more than anywhere else in the world. And I was curious, but I was also afraid of John because he could see right through me, and I wasn't doing your work. And if you got to know me, you wouldn't like me. So I stayed away from him after the meeting. But I loved when he was in there. I felt safe when John was around. And this thought, I knew I had to go see him, and I went back to my home group, and I used to sit over there, and he would sit over there, and I kind of moved myself like closer to him, you know? And after like 2 weeks, I was right next to him. And he said one day, you want me to sponsor you or something? I said, John, I never thought you'd ask. You know what I mean? It's like asking another man to be your Valentine. It's not easy. And John picked up on that. That's why he asked me. And my journey with the program began with John Bragg, the inside job, the one I was afraid of. But because I had John there and I trusted him a little bit, I started to do things that, to me on my own, looked like a bad idea. These all look like weaknesses to me. He said to me, as I said in the second step, formally, I said, I don't know if I deserve what you have, John. He said, Scott, you deserve to be sober. God wants you sober. Let's take these steps and let's see what happens. And I just said, okay, maybe. As we were going down to do the third step, I knew what we were doing. I heard stories. In fact, I knew a friend that went down there and did it with him. I didn't think getting on my knees with another man saying a prayer is a good idea. But I went down anyway. And before we got on our prayer, he explained to me what this prayer was. And it's real simple. He said, Scott, this is an all-in deal. One day at a time for the rest of your life, there is no more drinking. Girlfriend or no girlfriend, wife or no wife, money or no money, health or no health, you're going to walk this way with us and God. Are you in or you out? I said, I'm in. I made it. I've been honoring the commitment ever since. I made that commitment. I still feel it in my heart, no matter what. I got off my knees. I didn't feel any better. In fact, I felt worse. Seems to be a theme of my sobriety to this day, even. I feel like the last 6 years, every year I say it's been the hardest year of my life. But I got to tell you, as experienced members will tell you, and in our 11th step and the 12-1-12, I love where they talk about this. They're the most beautiful years. And I'll get into some of that. But I said on a very elementary level, not knowing, you know, I had to live that stuff out, which I'm still doing today, but I had to live out all that stuff that he just talked about. I said, I'm in. And I didn't feel any better. I felt worse, but I was better because he told me about a 4-step. And that didn't look like a good idea to me. And he reminded me what I did in the 3rd step. He said, you have God with you. Ask him for help. And I said that prayer, God, this does not look like a good idea to me, this 4-step. But if it is, I ask you for the courage to write, as the date was approaching that he set for me to do the 5th. And I asked my creator for help. And I put that pen on that paper and it wrote by itself for 2 hours. You've heard other members talk about it. And I called him up to tell him I was done, whereas before I told him, you know, I was afraid, and he laughed. Because he knew the power of God. And he knew if I asked with my heart, what was best for me would be done. Like they do in our literature. When Bill and Bob go see alcoholic number 3, Bill Dodds, right? Bill, but he says, I'm a goner, Bill D says. You can't help me. And they laugh. Because they know. And what happens? Bill D does take this. And Bill D never drinks again. My sponsor said, meet me in that park. And I went there and he wasn't there yet. And something said, get out of here right now. It's not a good idea. And something kept me there. And I went into the park when my sponsor got there with him. And I got spiritually naked in front of him and God. I was defenseless, unprotected, vulnerable. I left nothing out that I could think of. More things would be revealed to me later on in inventory, sure. But there was nothing I thought I'm not telling him. Or I put embarrassing things on there. And I sat there in the park and I was embarrassed as I handed him the 4-step. But shortly into that, I realized that this guy wasn't there to judge me, man. He was there to love me. And real simply, what he did for me in that park was show me the truth about me for the first time in my life. And what I saw was that he said to me things like this, Scott, why would people want to be around you? I said, I don't know if I'm funny. He said, no, why would they really want to be around you? I said, I don't know. He goes, maybe if you're honest. And my 4-step was riddled with dishonesty. Man, I lied to you since I was born. I was afraid in this world, and I wanted to feel equal, or you accept me, or a lot of times feel better than you. So I would exaggerate, lie, when the truth even served me right, like the book, like our literature talks about. I was a fraud. And he said, Scott, if you live like that, you're not going to feel connected to people, and they're not going to feel connected to you, and alcohol will show up in your life constantly. If you want booze out of your life, and you want to feel connected, you got to practice the principles of AA. One day at a time, with God's help for the rest of your life. And he sent me, we walked out of the park, and he said to me, Scott, I'm your sponsor, but I'm a human being, I'm fallible. God is all-powerful, infallible, infinite knowledge and wisdom. He said, that's the most important relationship you have. And Sam Shoemaker told Bill Wilson, when it comes to sponsorship, he said, when you see the man with the problem, put his hand in the hand of him who has all the answers, then go home. Don't stick around and play God. My sponsor put my dependence in his proper place. It's been there ever since. Now, I need you, but ultimately my dependence is in God. And I went home and I took that hour, and in that hour I reflected on my life, the things we talked about in that park. And as I sat there in that hour, like it hit me. Boom. I just felt the shame melt away. I felt forgiven by my Creator. I knew I was forgiven by my Creator. Because I started to take responsibility for the way I lived my life in the park with him and my sponsor. Now, I had more work to do with the world than I still do today, but I knew God forgave me. I had a clean slate with him. And a peace came to me that day that hasn't led me from that day to this day, no matter what happens. And I've had my time in the barrel, which I'll talk about. What an honor that has become. And I haven't wanted to drink from that moment to this moment. Because AA went from my head to my heart. It was no longer neck up, it was here. Right? So words you've never had to hear either of my sponsors say, Vance S. has been my sponsor for the last 7 or 8 years, is who you helping? Because when it goes here, it wants to come out and help. It doesn't have life unless it passes it on. And the experience wants to keep experiencing itself. Here's the fifth step promises coming true in my life. I went to my home group that night, and I was looking at my friend Elena's eyes. And for the first time in my life, I realized I'm looking in another human being's eyes. I don't want to leave him. I was comfortable. I was clean. Before that, I stared at your shoes. Another thing that happened to me that night that's very important was I took a man named Bill home who, for those 5 or 6 months of me being in here, going to AA and loving it, I was helping Bill with what I could help him with. Bill is schizophrenic. Bill will never drive. Bill can't hold a job. My parents showed me how to help the less fortunate. It's not hard for me to pick up a guy who doesn't have as much as I have and take him to lunch and buy him lunch, bring him to a meeting, sit next to him, tell him he's going to be okay. How you doing, bud? I can do that stuff. But I had nothing real in the way of our program to offer Bill because I wasn't taking your steps. But that night I had something extra. I took your fifth earlier in the day and I said to Bill on the way home, Bill, you have a sponsor. I said that to Bill because I wanted him to experience what I did earlier in the day. And he said, yeah, you. And I said, I'll take you as far as I can, Bill. And the next day, we were looking at the first three steps. So I'm fumbling through that with him. And then, you know, he's afraid to write his four steps. So I say, say a prayer. Remember what you did in the third. And he says that, and he writes it. And I end up in a park with Bill. What an honor that is, to listen to another man's fifth step. What an honor. And as tears are rolling down my cheeks in that park uncontrollably, because for the first time in my life, I was unconditionally in love with another human being. I would have spent as much time as it took in the park for Bill to know God's real, for him to know he's loved and forgiven, for him to know he never has to drink again. I would have given up anything that had been given to me materially for this guy to have a purpose like I did with him in the park that day. And it's been my purpose ever since. It's the reason why I come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I haven't heard my sponsor or his sponsor, God rest his soul, he's passed on, but I haven't heard either of them ever complain in a meeting about their life, man. Neither have I. I mean, I've come here hurt. I've come here in pain. I've come here with resentment. When I come through these doors, I realize that the greatest thing on earth that can happen to me happened here. And I want to share that with whoever's still can't stop drinking. And here's what else happened to me from having a guy right behind me. Just trying with him is that I made all my amends, the easy ones. You know, I ran off and made all the easy amends, the ex-girlfriend, the other ex-girlfriend. The financial ones were easy for me. I don't know why, but like I had a business going. I had a second business going. I had money in the bank. I drove around in $500 cars. I bought up the long timers, like a 86 Mercury Lynx with a push button radio and no heat and a full on roof. We still talk about that, my friends and I, so I could pay back every dime I owed. And I did that because it wasn't intimate or personal for me. It was like, if I took 500 from you, I know I owe you 500 and I want to stay sober and I'm willing to go to any lengths. Here's 500. I understood that concept. It wasn't hard for me. What was hard for me? My sister, my brother, my mother, my grandmother, my father who I stole from for years, but I had Bill right behind me. Bill was catching up to me. And I had Bill on his eight-step list. And I cared enough about Bill to be an example to him, to stay one step ahead of him. So Bill motivated me, inspired me to stay right ahead, just a step ahead of him. So I pray. I did what the eight-step tells us when we're afraid to do our amends. I prayed, right? And I asked for the courage, and boom, I was given it. Go see your brother. I make the phone call. I was on the phone with my brother the other day. It's amazing. I call my brother up and I said, I got to come talk to you. He says, okay. We set up a date. I go and sit with him and I start crying like a baby. And he doesn't even know what's going on. I break down right in front of him. He has no idea. I settled down finally. And I open up. And I own the way I treated him. In a sincere way. And he stood up after this direct amen and hugged me and said, I don't know if I could ever be as honest as you were right there. And I said, I don't know how you don't hate me. And I left my brother's apartment that day in Center City, Philly, and I drove home and I realized something. I realized that from the first time in my life after that, I had a relationship with him. Now, I hadn't been hurting my brother or drinking for many months, 6, 7, 8, whatever it was. But I didn't have a relationship with him until I looked him in the eyes and took responsibility for the way I treated him. And here's what happened from that. My brother asked me to take him through the steps of AA not too long after that. And he's an alcoholic. But I guess he saw what they did with his older brother, and he wanted maybe to something more out of life. And we sat down. I told you I'm not a student. He's a history teacher. He gave me a history lesson every Sunday for 6 months. And I would take him through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous one by one, and we would end up listening to his, I did his fifth step in his house in Philly, right where I did the amend and direct amend. And man, his fourth step was a joke. It was a joke. He had like a couple names on there. Like his wife sometimes annoys him. You know, we looked at it from an entirely different angle. You know, and he saw he was selfish and inconsiderate. And then we went through the whole thing, and there was one name on there he harmed, one person his whole life. This is how good of a life this guy lived. His ex-girlfriend, Sarah, from 12 years prior, he hasn't seen since, doesn't know where she lives. He cheated on her and broke and left her. Very uncharacteristic of him. Always felt guilty about it. I said, you got to put her on your eight-step list. Well, someday you got to make it right. So a few months go by, I get this text message, ran into Sarah at the Austin airport, made amends, incredible. He gets on the phone with me, he goes, you're not going to believe it, Scott. He's in Texas visiting my sister. His flight gets delayed, he's walking to the airport. The one person, Sarah, on his list is in, he crosses her and locks eyes with her. She was with her brother, he's with his wife. They go to the bathroom at the same time, he was prepared to do what he had to do. He made the amend. She forgave him. He called me and said, he called my mom and said he physically felt different. When he did that, he told me it was the best experience he ever had in his life. My brother moved to New Zealand shortly afterwards, and I told him how we live in 10, 11, 12, because to me it's a way of life. It's not a study or mechanics. It's a way of life. And he moved over to New Zealand when he had his son and I, my nephew, and I got to go over there with my aunt, my sister, and my mother to see my nephew for the first time. We went and took a ride, and he told me how he set up an amends for the following week with his sister-in-law. How the way he reacted to her, he could see it's going to cause problems with the family and the relationship with his son. And he doesn't want that. And he wants to fix it right now. This guy's working the program faster than I am. It's enriching his life and those around him. And that's what this is all about. I was never a grandson. You said go be a grandson. Show up at your grandmother's house. She's 86 years old living in a nursing home with a walker. I'd show up, play card games or whatever she wanted to do. Not that I like these card games, but I'd just show up. Let her get to know me. That's all they want to do is get to know you, your mother, your grandmother, your father. They want to spend time with you. I never spent time with any of my family, ever. And now I'm showing up at this nursing home. And I got to know my grandmother, and I asked her one day, hey, you know, what are your hobbies? And one of the things she liked to do was go to Atlantic City. So I started taking her to Atlantic City once a month, twice a month. And then she'd want to stay there all day, you know, but spend $20, you know. I bring spiritual books and bring them to the casinos because I'm not a big gambler. And on the way home, one of these trips, I said, Grandma, if you hit big, what would you do? She said, I know exactly what I would do, without hesitating. She said, I would hire a driver to take me up to New England where I was born and raised before I die, but I know it'll never happen. I told you I'm making all my financial amends, right? A funny thing happens when you do that. It's not why we do it, but when you do that, you can actually keep money and it can grow. Because I'm not working from a deficit anymore. I don't owe the world money, so I can now keep it. It can come to me, and I'm self-employed. Once she told me that, I knew I wanted to do it with her, and I called my grandma up and I said, Grandma, I want to do that trip with you. She said, what trip? I said, the one you talked about. She goes, oh, I remember. I said, I want to do it with you. She said, what do you mean? I don't have any money. I said, I have money. She said, I wouldn't need my own room. I'm old. You wouldn't have any fun. And I had to beg her to let me take her, and she allowed me to take her. I picked up my grandmother. Took her for 8 days up to New England, Lisbon, New Hampshire, 91-year-old brother, 84-year-old sister, spent the whole day, got to know them better. The next day was my favorite day, man. Her 86-year-old best friend, we walked up these stairs, took like half the day to walk up. Right, we get in the living room, we spend the rest of the day there, they're laughing and crying, I'm laughing and crying. I took my grandma to the field she used to run and play in, where she had her first kiss, the church she was a part of. I mean, we had a blast. We even stopped at a nudist colony in Massachusetts on the way home, you know? She wanted to go in, and she lived life to the fullest. Got pictures and everything. But we get back from this trip, and my grandmother falls ill, and she dies. And she had 7 children, one of being my mother, and they all came up to me and told me from the day she got back to the day she died, all she wanted to do was talk about that trip and how much fun she had. On her deathbed, she would want to break out the photo album and show her kids the fun we had and a great time we had. And they asked me to say some last words at her funeral. Now, before that, I wasn't allowed around the family. Or if I was, they didn't trust me. Walking on eggshells. Now they're giving me the honor of saying some last words at my grandmother's funeral. So thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for allowing me to be a part of my grandmother's last wish on earth. And that is my favorite trip I've ever been on. Those trips, dreams of travel for me have come true. It's not way to go, Scott. It's way to go, God, and way to go, AA. But because of God and because of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have given me the opportunity to travel to 75 countries since I've been sober. I never left Levittown before I got here. I learned how to surf in Waikiki at the Hawaii Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous at a year sober. I learned how to ride elephants in Thailand and Laos at the Thailand Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned how to scuba dive in Indonesia at the Bali Roundup of Alcoholics Anonymous at 10 years sober with some of my mentors from all over the world. 95% of my travels have been inside AA. I have friends all over the world. I have friends in Australia whose kids, you know, asking about how Scott's doing. I have guys and women in AA in Canada who check with me on a weekly or bi-weekly basis. All over the world. When I got here, I was all alone. And my life takes off. And the inside gets right and the outside becomes abundant, which is okay. That's not what it's about, but it's okay. And, what happens to me is that around 8-9 years sober, man, I get leveled. And I get put in a fetal position. The girl I wanted, that I was in love with, couldn't have. Heartbroken. The guy that was running my business for 4 years, I sponsored his sponsor, robbed me for everything I had. Haven't seen him since. I'm in the darkness. I don't know what to do. I never experienced this pain, but I realized something at that eight year sobriety mark where all this stuff was happening to me emotionally was that I realized how little I really do know about life. And it allowed me to get humble. Now, I know everything because I know God's real, but when it comes to life, I had little experience. I'm a baby. Right now, I'm 16 years of experience living life in reality. And when that happened, man, I had that broken heart and I had that money robbed and the business pretty much vanished and I was in that fetal position. I couldn't move for 2 days. I had to let friends carry me. I learned so much about our tradition, one, in my life and in my business. And as soon as that happened, this guy shows up in my life who can't stay sober for 7 years. He's all over the place. Now, I have no girlfriend and no business. I have all the time in the world to give this guy. And I'm picking him up early in the morning. I'm driving around all day and I'm hurting, man. I was in that pain for over a year. But I had this guy right next to me, man. I got to watch this guy clean up and start sponsoring other guys and start a meeting that, you know, in my area and you know, he didn't have teeth, and I took him, helped him get, you know, teeth, and he never had a license because he'd been in jail for so long. I took him permit, license. I got to do this with this guy. And I remember one day watching him, like, up there shining, speaking or something. I thought, man, that's why that girl and that money had to go from my life is because this guy needed me. Like, he needed all of me. Then I realized I had it backwards. But I needed him. And that in the hardest time of my life, to that date, God put a new guy in my life to love, and he's who carried me out of that pain. And I was reminded in that of what this is really about. Because I can forget. And I've come to really, I'm not at the point where I think, I can't wait for hard things to happen in my life or challenges. But I got to tell you something. I stand here truthfully saying I value the hard times more than I value when it feels good in here. Like when I'm on top of a glacier on a snowmobile above the clouds with my mom in Iceland, which I've been saying, this is amazing. You know, that feels good. But I don't learn up there. I seem to learn in the fire. And I've come to, with the help of my sponsor, Vance S. from West Philly, I've come to really look at pain as not a something bad in my life, but it's actually a gift. Because he showed me. He was a living example. He was a guy that, you know, had cancer of the lungs, and then he was about to make the Olympic team, his dream, and it got taken from him. He couldn't get out of bed with some rare spinal thing, and it got wiped out. And then he got brain cancer a few years ago, and I got to be in the hospital with him, and he told the doctor, you could trust him, I'd tell him anything to me. What an honor. But what he showed me in that is I said, God, thank you, when I got that brain cancer. He said, Scott, when I was going, when he's 30-some years old, because when I was new, I would watch the old long-timers come in, and they would go through things, and they would show me how I can stay sober through anything. He said, now this is my turn to be in the barrel and show other people. I'm getting the goosebumps right now, because that's how I look at it, right? I'm not running today from hard times. I'm not running from pain. Have I put my head in the sand with responsibilities? Of course I have. This last year and a half, I can't even explain to you how hard it was. 18 months ago, 2 years ago, I was in another fetal position, my own doing, on the tile floor, in the kitchen, 14 and a half years sober, whatever I was, begging God, couldn't sleep for 3 nights, financial fear, begging Him. I purged it up, I could feel it. But I have been putting my head in the sand for years, man. I knew that, you know, I would travel and I would feel this thing inside me and I would ignore it, right? But I've also come to not hate myself or be ashamed of that. It's part of me growing up. And ultimately, you know what you've given me in here? What Bill Wilson talks about in the 12 and 12. In the 12 step. Joy of living. You've given me joy. You've given me the whole spectrum of life. You've given me reality. Like at 38 years old, when I went through another heartbreak, and I'm at my mom and dad's house, my first one actually, and I'm crying. And part of me is embarrassed or ashamed that I'm in front of my mother and father, 30-year-old man, crying. Because number one, I'd never let anyone see me cry over a girl, or admit defeat or that I'm hurting or that maybe, you know, whatever. And part of me is embarrassed, and then part of me realizes the gift. I should have been doing that at 16 to 17 with my parents, but no, I wasn't in reality. I was drinking. I was too afraid to live, and I wouldn't show anyone that, and I never went through that because I just drank it away. And here I am, sober, hurting in front of my mom and dad. Can you imagine what a gift that is to them? That they watch their son. That in those moments, tell me my mother and father aren't more secure that I'm not going to go back to drinking. Because you know, when I was in Jamaica and I couldn't find a meeting because they only have one meeting a week in Jamaica, and I wasn't there during that. My mom is saying to my sister, as I'm sitting in a bar watching, you know, with a club soda watching the thing, which I'm fine with. My mom's sitting to my sister, and I forget how long sober I was, but I was years sober. Is Scott okay? Is he okay? Is he going to go to a meeting? Do you think he's going to drink? This is years sober with sponsees and commitments and all that. Can you imagine? When you let your mother and father know who you are, or us when you're in pain, or your friends that you're, you know, you don't have all the answers, can you imagine what that does for them? So you've given me that. You've given me the ability to grow up and be a man. I feel like I'm really, you know, in that stage of emotional sobriety, man. There's things right now God's pulling on me saying, come on, let this go. There's greater things on the other side. And I know there is, but I'm not ready to give it up. But I took the third step. And my 6 and 7 is, man, I will change before I drink. It doesn't mean I'm trying to like wait till I drink. I'm just saying that I am committed to the change. As long and as hard as the process is, I am going to keep going to God and keep coming in here. If you're new, my saving grace is I've never left the center of AA. I've never taken a vacation. Maybe people have and they're okay. I just haven't. My heroes who I hang out with love AA, love the history of AA. We have a common bond when we see each other, you know, and because we know this gift we've been given and we love giving it back and preserving it or carrying it on to the next. I just hope that Bill and Bob and Ernie G and Henrietta and Ann and Lois and any alcoholic or non-alcoholic up in that sky right now at the big meeting looking down here is saying that kid Scott's doing a pretty good job with the gift we left him. Man, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I just hope tomorrow I come back and I'm a better member than I was today. And it seems that every time I do that and I I focus on that, it seems that everything else in my life is added to me. I believe that the curse of alcoholism has become a gift of alcoholism in my life. And that's why I'm on this earth. So I have AA to thank for that. And I have AA to keep coming back and not just saying that in word, but in deed, showing that. I continue to have a job in my home group. I continue to learn about the steps and the traditions and study our concepts and things that most people don't even know about, right? I continue to learn about our history and go to conventions and conferences. I continue all that stuff so I could be a better member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never had purpose, man. I had purpose today. Without you, there is no me. Thank you so much for letting me share.